World leaders are in New York for the United Nations General Assembly, but countries are increasingly divided on major crises, from climate change and the pandemic to Afghanistan. So, is there a future for global cooperation? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the programme. I'm Imran Khan. After a year of virtual meetings, world leaders and diplomats are back in New York to attend the United Nations General Assembly this week. They've a lot to get through. Climate change is a major concern just 6 weeks before the next major UN summit in Glasgow. Access to COVID-19 vaccines will also be discussed. The UN Secretary General says growing mistrust between countries is making it difficult for the United Nations to tackle global crises. He's particularly concerned about the relationship between China and the United States, calling it totally dysfunctional. Antonio Guterres urged the two superpowers to repair ties or risk dividing the world with a new Cold War.
The Cold War created clear rules, and there was a conscience of the problem and of the risks. Namely, the risk of nuclear destruction. And that allowed to create a number of mechanisms. There were back channels always working. There were several forms to guarantee that things would not get out of control. Now, today, everything is more fluid. And even the experience that existed in the past to manage crises is no longer there. With all these differences, one thing is clear. We have only one planet. And all these countries are powerful enough for the fact that they are at odds with each other completely to be a mechanism that undermines our capacity to deal with the global challenges we face.
The UN sees this year's session as a potential turning point in several major areas. The world body is urging more countries to set ambitious goals for carbon neutrality. The UN's analysis shows global emissions will be 16% higher in 2030 than they were in 2010. It also wants to ensure equal access to vaccines against the coronavirus. The World Health Organization says 70% of COVID-19 doses are administered in only 10 countries. And it also needs to decide on how newly formed governments in certain countries should be approached. The Taliban takeover in Afghanistan and the military coup in Myanmar are at the top of the agenda. Let's bring in our guests in Islamabad, Simbul Khan, peace and security consultant at UNDP Pakistan. In Istanbul, Matthew Breiser, former US diplomat and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. And in Cape Town, Sanusha Naidu, senior research fellow at the Institute for Global Dialogue, a South African think tank. Welcome to the programme. I'd like to begin in Istanbul first with Matthew Breiser. The UN's been a powerhouse organisation since 1945, but it's more divided now than ever. The simple question is, has the UN failed in its mandate?
Yeah, thanks, Imran, for that great question. It depends on what you consider the mandate to be. I mean, I think the Security Council is definitely failing. Everything or anything that three of the permanent members, United States, United Kingdom, and France propose, Russia and China oppose. And so, you know, the Security Council is supposed to be the highest body in terms of formulating international law, but it has no enforcement mechanisms. So that's failed. But the UN has done some great things in terms of delivering humanitarian assistance, fostering cooperation, and just getting people to know about the awareness about humanitarian problems around the world or the plight of women and girls in certain parts of the world. UNICEF does great work in helping children. But overall, it's an unwieldy organization. And its aspirations, I think, usually far exceed its outcomes. And we see that now with the World Health Organization, which really has not been able to do much at all to respond to the COVID-19 pandemic. So it's a mixed record.
But Matthew, it's interesting you make the point that it's unwieldy, because if this was a company in the United States, Congress would be looking to break it up. But we're not. They're not doing that. Like you say, UNICEF does great work. Other parts of the organization do great work. But as a whole, when it comes to what Antonio Guterres says, more multilateralism, it's simply not doing that.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And that's, you know, partially a symptom of the world we live in today that's so divided, both, again, between the United States and Europe on one side and China and Russia on the other side, or between North and South. This has been for decades, the North and the South disagreeing on how to allocate resources. We see that in the climate change battle as well, where, you know, the so-called Western countries, or the North, the wealthier countries, are not fulfilling the pledges that they've made to help developing countries who really aren't responsible for so much of the climate change crisis to meet their targets. So, you're right. If this were a company, it would probably be broken up. But this is an unusual organization in that it's comprised of sovereign member states. And, you know, UN reform is a perennial topic. It's been out there for decades. Here in Turkey, where I live, it's quite a big issue to think about or to try to expand the membership of the Security Council beyond five. It's the President Erdogan's slogan is the world is bigger than five. So some countries really do want to expand the United Nations. But from my perspective, it's too big.
Sanusha Naidoo in Cape Town, you work for a institute called Global Dialogue, but the UN doesn't seem to have much of that going on, does it, at the moment?
Good day, Imran, and to my fellow colleagues. Yeah, it's quite an interesting question. I mean, I think global dialogue is also the question of how you frame the dialogue and what you want the dialogue to essentially cover. I think you can have your broad trajectories around global dialogue. You can talk about the big ticket issues. You can talk about climate change. You can talk about the fact that you need peace, stability, and development. You can talk about the fact that, you know, the humanitarian security issues are exacerbated under the COVID-19 conditions, but it's also about questions of how do you create prosperity and common peace and stability for everybody, an inclusive development agenda. I think where the challenges lie is actually coming down to those power dynamics, what Matthew referred to, but also how do you get those power dynamics to become much more equitable? More importantly, how do you redistribute power in the global arena? And I think that's the bigger challenge. Nobody wants to give up their power. Nobody wants to be seen as vulnerable in terms of where the power dynamics lie. And I agree, there are pockets of excellence in the UN that we need to look at and extrapolate lessons around. But I guess whilst the world still reflects a power imbalance, I think these tensions will continue to arise. Who's going to basically decide that I'm going to decarbonize and move towards a better environmental footprint? There's a lot of questions here. And I think the challenge is, you know, how do you get those agreements to be practical, but also get them to be implemented and operationalized?
Simbel Khan, Islamabad. Often what I hear from defenders of the UN is, yes, OK, it is flawed. It's a flawed system, but it's the only system we've got. Do you agree with that?
Yes, thank you, Imran. And I think I absolutely agree with that. And also the contention, also the points that my colleagues have just made before, I totally agree with it. There are hits and misses. We are living in an unequal world. UN system has tried to work in a world where inequality within regions, within countries, across regions globally has been rising. Any kind of a system, whether it was earlier, we saw a whole kind of a communist system and socialist system ideologies working in the 80s and 90s post-war in the post-World War before the end of history, that was a struggle and there was a hope that maybe this inequitable distribution of power and wealth could be fixed but didn't get fixed. And then we came to the end of history where the capitalist system apparently and the capitalist world had won. And we had a unipolar system where America dominated, the US dominated the world. And I think under that phase, we saw a little bit more space for multilateralism because a lot of collective action between countries was happening under the leadership, on the Western or basically US leadership. But since the last two decades, we've seen a shift in global power. You've seen a more like a shift to what you call a multipolar world. So multilateralism for me is now challenging in a multipolar world. How do you work together in a country, in a globe or in a world, in a system where, first of all, their rising security and political challenges and acceptance of the rise of China, for example. And, you know, basically Russia and China kind of coalescing together in a bloc against, say, some of the older Western power centers. And then you have new power centers like India coming in. So I think the functional disconnect, as was said by my other colleagues, in certain areas, UN is delivering. Even right now, for example, the example of Afghanistan, the most fastest action that we have seen right now is coming by the UN on the humanitarian space, while all the other countries are shoving and still thinking about how to kind of bring together collective action on political and security level to the Taliban takeover. The UN, through its humanitarian work, is the fast responder. It is going to step in, and it has stepped in to do some very important work. UNICEF is there, WHO is stepping in. So we need that, and I think that is the reason why UN system continues despite its problems. But on a growing multilateral divide in a multipolar world where you have rising concerns of with China, you've seen this new deal coming up between the US, UK, as well as Australia, splitting Europe altogether. So for, I'm afraid multilateral collective action is becoming more and more difficult. I'll stop here.
Matthew, what's the point of the UN if multilateralism isn't built in, isn't part of its DNA? If it simply can't do that, what's the point?
Well, as you were saying earlier, Imran, I mean, it's we need somewhere where people can countries can gather, where sovereign states can exchange views, can try to pull in the same direction wherever possible. In my experience, in my diplomatic career, I always felt it was important to sustain a regime or an organized form of behavior among sovereign states, because they're very difficult to build in the first place, and it's really hard to get countries to agree on the same rules and norms. Or common rules and norms. So, it's really something we do need to preserve because it's the best we have. But the big problem is that the UN was forged in a spirit of common interest, right, where everybody in the Security Council, after the horrors of World War II, the Holocaust, everything else, and World War I, wanted to start over and wanted to try to work together. So we got something out of that effort called the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But in reality, Russia and China don't accept the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And this whole rules-based system that the UN is supposed to help nurture and protect is being rejected and undermined by those countries every day in the Security Council. So the world is a brutal place. Power really means something. And often, power can really destroy the best laid plans whose foundation is beautiful and is about a shared ideology of doing good things for humanity.
Sanusha, I want you to pick up on that point. Matthew says, actually, look, it's Russia and China's fault. They have this veto of the Security Council. They often disagree on human rights and things like that. But he's American, so he's going to say that, right? I mean, Sanusha, there is an inbuilt, I don't want to say racism, but certainly inbuilt prejudice to up-and-coming economies, up-and-coming nation states, more powerful nations, surely, like South Africa.
Oh, thank you, Imran. I mean, yeah, it's precisely the nature of the way the Security Council was built. I think when you go back and you look at the point that Matthew makes about the forged common interest and how it was how that came about, yes, it was after the period of 1945. You've got this dynamic of the global system and the way in which the power dynamics evolved at that time. And it strikes me that we're still trying to forge that system on the basis of how the world was perceived after 1945. Yes, indeed, I think that the idea of common interest, common prosperity, and the ideologies are important. But I think what is also important is how does the UN evolve within the changing structural conditions in the global arena? And I'm just wondering, as a proposal, perhaps the idea of what we talk about in terms of some of the structural flaws and contradictions that exist within the Security Council in terms of how they manage the peace and security and the interventions and the idea of the human rights debates and so forth, is that does everything that goes into the UN Security Council have to be about how interests are actually defined and devolved and designed in that UN Security Council? Perhaps the real challenge for us in terms of the way the UN has to become fit for purpose as it moves forward in a changing global architecture and the multipolarity and the multilateralism that we have been discussing is the question of what is the viability of the Security Council? Is the Security Council the real issue here and not the entire UN architecture as it exists today? I think that's the bigger, the existential question we have to confront in the context of the reform and transform agenda and the fact that it has always been a perennial issue in terms of what happens, because that's where the vested interests are. Perhaps the challenge is to ask the question is, do you need the veto for all the permanent states in the Security Council?
The Security Council is one of the most interesting bits, but Symbol, I also want to talk to you about change and change in the United Nations. Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General, has been very clear. Multilateralism is the way forward. He said this publicly in several interviews. He keeps giving the same message to anybody that he speaks to, but he's dealing with 198 sovereign nations. Now, he can't dictate to those nations, and change has to come from somewhere. Are there a few key players, Symbol, holding this change up? Is it China and the US, as now Antonio Guterres is saying?
Yes, absolutely. And I think echoing what has been said before, again, especially the last speaker who talked about the power dynamic, as long as global actions and politics and security are stuck in the power dynamic, and we haven't moved away from that world. Even national sovereignty, national wealth, national definition of nation states are tied to a sense of power. I mean, we define nation state systems through the level of, you know, elements of power that these countries possess, and there are certain securities that national sovereignties have. We've had that huge issue about it when we you know, in the whole framework of, which was very central to the UN's role, especially in basically in the developing world, which was linked to the responsibility to protect. That whole edifice of responsibility to protect never got that universal acceptance among the sovereign countries, especially in the global south. We thought that that will become an instrument of UN's intervention, or basically that UN will become a front for intervention of big global powers into their internal affairs. So sovereignty, national sovereignty, has always clashed with this big, larger multilateralism that UN has represented. And I don't think that's changing. I think the issue still remains stuck with a definition of who shapes things in the world, even how China has been defined, how China's role in the future has been defined, is by kind of laying out how much naval power China is building up, or how much of an extension through CPEC or BRI that China is accruing, how much economic power it's accruing. Although on one side, we do have a global consensus on this SDG 17, for example. I mean, the whole global community, 198 plus countries, agree to certain pathway forward for the next 20 years or so, what we need to do in our countries to move forward. On one side, we do have that. But on the other side, how things move, how you move things around and who gets what is still defined not on principles. It is sometimes kind of couched in this like global universal values, but often the developing world feels, and often even China feels, that that is being defined by kind of power principles linked to the advanced Western world, who wants to kind of maintain that positions of power. So till we are stuck into the security and power dynamic, global community, humanity still remains stuck in it. I don't think we are completely shifting on to the real purpose of why we had set up a global organization and why we continue to work with a global organization. And I think majority of the world, and especially developing world, still sees a lot of value in the UN. Yes, Security Council, I absolutely agree with this previous speakers. It's almost been a kind of a death knell on UN and how much action. But that is defining your global system. It is, I think, a little bigger and beyond the UN system, this whole idea of how power is being held by what defines power.
But Matthew, is it bigger? One of the things that Symbol Khan has just said is that, look, there are fundamental disagreements on things like security, on things like arms treaties and things like this. However, one of the things that might be able to unite the UN is if they stop looking at the world through a security prism and start looking at it through climate change, for example, something that affects every single country on the planet. Is the UN's remit too wide? Does it need to be narrower in order to be able to unite?
No, I don't think so. I don't think an organization, any organization, is ever going to be able to compel very powerful state actors to do anything. The state actors have to want to do it. And so to me, the problem is one of, put it in simple terms, you can use a fancy word like parochialism or just selfishness. I mean, if COVID-19, if this crisis that really does affect everyone, if that can't bring us all together, I think there just is a fundamental problem of selfishness in the haves, in the countries that have the vaccines, that have the wealth. Sure, the United States, there are millions of people who want to do good. And who are doing good. And the United States is, you know, stepping up and providing, you know, billions of dollars to deliver vaccines around the world, but it's not enough. And we've got, you know, as the head of the World Health Organization, Mr. Ghebreyesus has said many times, you know, the United States and other countries shouldn't be moving toward booster shots, so third vaccines for the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines or Pfizer-BioNTech, before we get, you know, do much better in Africa, where I think only 2% of the population has been vaccinated. You know, we lamented in the United States only, you know, around 70% of the population has had their first dose, and then 58% have had their second dose. And in Africa, all the entire continent, 2% of people have gotten the vaccines. So we all need to be better human beings and care about what's happening in the world beyond our borders. Because as we see with the so-called Delta variants, no matter how vaccinated we may be in the United States, that variant has come back and has put us right back in the United States in a terrible new surge of COVID-19. So I'm just really pessimistic that organizational reform is going to make the human character better. But hopefully climate change and the question of our very existence is going to bring us together.
The solution I do, if it's not climate change, if it's not an existential dread about our existence that's going to bring us together, what is the UN for?
Well, I think the problem here is also trying to understand the value system. I think the value system is really the question about how do you actually move beyond this question about what are interests, how countries in the UN system define their collective interest or their national interest in the context of the of this entire organization. I have to say that parts of the debate about whether or not we look at the lens of security in a very state-centric approach or whether we have to look at it in a collective approach and what the collective means in terms of a collective humanity, I think comes back to how you change the way we look at the nation state states as component parts of the bigger. I think the real challenge is really around the question of how do we drive that value addition of human security and, more importantly, the question of a collective humanity. But I think the challenge is whether or not we're going to move out of that state-centric view and whether we are going to create that bigger kind of universal value system that is not necessarily unique to particular countries or regions or particular ideological leanings, but it's just a complete universal kind of intrinsic value system. Because if we are going to say that climate change is an existential threat to humanity, then of course all of what we are seeing in the UN system now is for naught. Because if humanity is reaching a kind of tipping point in its survival, then where do we go with the UN system? And I think at the end of the day...
Sorry, Sunusha, we are running out of time, and I do want to put this point to Simbel Khan. We are running out of time, but Simbel, the League of Nations was disbanded after the Second World War simply because it failed. It failed to stop the horrors of that particular war. Then we rebranded almost and we became the United Nations. It's been 30 years and we haven't had any real action on climate change. Is it time to disband the UN?
No. I don't think so. I think UN steps in, as I said earlier, in very areas for humanitarian support where no other organization right now exists to provide that kind of support, quick action. There are certain areas where, of course, it's a very contested debate about universal values. What are defined? How do we define universal values? But I think SDGs in their very basic way do capture some of the universal values which are not really contested. Rights of women, education for women, safety and security for children, food, health care. there's hardly any contestation. And UN right now today provides that kind of support, provides capacity building support. So we don't disband the UN. Absolutely not. And I think there's a huge need for that. Yes, it is not being able to fulfill the reasons that it was set up for, but we don't have anything else to replace it right now. Maybe a third world war where we are, you know, if this whole kind of narratives about nuclear submarines and more arms build and more kind of war continues, yeah, maybe we will lead to a point of collapse there where we do set up something new. But right now, there's a huge need for the UN, and I'm glad it's there.
I want to thank all our guests, Simbel Khan in Islamabad, in Istanbul, Matthew Brizza, and in Cape Town, Sanusha Naidu. And I want to thank you too for watching. Now, you can see the programme again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. And you can also join the conversation on Twitter. We are at AJInsideStory. From me, Imran Khan, and the whole team here, bye for now.